This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So, give me great pleasure to introduce next speaker, Jennifer Lai. Jennifer, for all of us who attend a lot of these national meetings, ASLD, and you see Jen's name everywhere, and Jen really has blossomed in the national scene in terms of her research and has really many innovative ideas in research related to liver transplant outcomes. And, you know, it's not the right time for her to talk about her research yet, but she's going to address this very important topic of pregnancy in liver disease. Jen.
Yes. Thank you very much, Francis. That was a very kind introduction. And thank you to all of you for coming here. It's really a pleasure to see all of you and to be able to give this talk on a very interesting topic. It's a very big topic to cover in just 20 minutes, so I have included in your syllabus some of the key points in your kind of that summarize a lot of these slides and a lot of the diseases, and the really key slides are the ones highlighted with the orange star here. So before we can really talk about liver disease in pregnancy, we first should just remind ourselves about what changes in pregnancy are considered normal. So this table summarizes some of the common laboratory tests that we're going to be asked to interpret when we consult on patients with liver disease in pregnancy. And you'll note that there are a couple of laboratory tests that are routinely elevated and in an expected fashion: white blood cell count, alkaline phosphatase, and the alpha-fetoprotein. Hemoglobin, total bilirubin, and albumin are routinely decreased, and the platelets, prothrombin time, AST, and ALT remain normal during pregnancy. So when you are being consulted on a woman who's pregnant with abnormal liver tests, the differential diagnosis actually can be divided by trimester. In the first trimester, there's really only one liver disease that is unique to pregnancy that can cause abnormal liver tests, and that's hyperemesis gravidarum. In the second trimester, towards the end of the second trimester, we can see intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, and at the very end of the second trimester, HELLP syndrome can start to appear, but really these become more severe and more prominent in the third trimester. And acute fatty liver of pregnancy and hepatic hematoma rupture are really limited to the third trimester of pregnancy. But of course, what makes making the diagnosis of abnormal liver tests in a pregnant woman so difficult is that pregnant women can get diseases that are not just unique to pregnancy, but they can get diseases that are common to them in non-pregnant states, such as viral hepatitis, drug-induced hepatitis, gallstone disease, Budd-Chiari syndrome, and acute hepatitis E, and those can occur at any time during the pregnancy. So today, I'd like to cover a couple of topics to recognize liver diseases that are unique to pregnancy, but also, perhaps more importantly and more commonly, to manage pre-existing chronic liver diseases during pregnancy, and then finally to diagnose and manage liver diseases that are coincident with pregnancy. So first, I'm going to just go through the four diseases, liver diseases that are unique to pregnancy. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly because actually, typically, these are diagnosed by OBs, and typically the management is immediate delivery, and so we're actually not involved too extensively except to help make the diagnosis. With hyperemesis gravidarum, this is the one disease that's unique to pregnancy that really can occur during the first trimester. The average gestational age is about 11.3 weeks. About two-thirds of pregnant women have liver enzyme abnormalities that happens to have an AST predominance over ALT. The diagnosis can be made purely based on clinical presentation, as well as ruling out some of the common other liver diseases that can occur in non-pregnant states. Management is purely supportive with hydration. As a rule, hyperemesis gravidarum and the liver test enzyme abnormalities that come with it always resolves by the 20th week. So if you are heading into the late late part of the second trimester and the woman still has abnormal liver tests, you really have to be thinking about something else. The prognosis is very favorable. Maternal fetal mortality is extremely rarely reported, but hyperemesis gravidarum commonly recurs. Intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy occurs on the order of 0.3 to 5% of pregnancies. There is an ethnic predominance among Latinos. It can be seen initially in the second trimester, but becomes more severe by the third trimester. The clinical presentation is pretty classic. It's severe pruritus, particularly on the palms and soles, and you can tell a pregnant woman has ICP when they come in with excoriations. Really, a woman who has pruritus, palms and soles, excoriations, and abnormalities in the liver enzymes really has ICP until proven otherwise. The alkaline phosphatase will oftentimes be elevated in ICP, but it is also elevated in pregnancy, and so it's not a very sensitive or specific marker for the diagnosis. What is an elevated ALT. Serum bile acids, if it can be drawn in your center, are useful, but they oftentimes come back a week later. But a serum bile acid greater than 10 can help you make the diagnosis. Patients with ICP can also have elevated INRs, but this is not from fulminant hepatic failure. This is from vitamin K deficiency. ICP does not progress to fulminant hepatic failure. ICP is associated with very favorable maternal outcomes, but does recur in about 60 to 70% of cases. But it is the fetal outcome of intrauterine fetal demise that occurs up to 3% that really is the dreaded outcome. Management is with ursodiol, so this will manage the pruritus and is quite effective and more effective than cholestyramine for the management of the pruritus and is dosed at 15 milligrams per kilogram per day, similar to PBC. And although there are no randomized controlled trials to support this, pretty generally OBGYNs are recommending delivery at 37 to 38 weeks of gestational age. And the risk of intrauterine fetal demise increases with serum bile acid levels greater than 40. And so OBGYNs will tend to deliver on the earlier side when the serum bile acid levels are quite elevated. There are a cluster of hypertension-related diseases that fall along the spectrum of preeclampsia to help that can result in hepatic hematoma rupture. In about 20 to 30% of cases of preeclampsia or eclampsia, liver enzymes will be elevated. But as the disease progresses, 5 to 10% of women with preeclampsia can develop HELLP syndrome, which is hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. Specifically, the AST has to be greater than 70, LDH greater than 100, and the platelet count less than 100. Remember, the platelet count is not expected to be abnormal in any way during pregnancy. If the hypertension-related disease becomes very severe in the setting of very high blood pressures, hepatic hematoma can rupture, and this is characterized by severe sudden right upper quadrant pain as well as shock. AST and ALT can rise above 1,000 in the setting of really hypoperfusion of the liver, and of course management of that has to be with hepatic angiography, and if that fails, then surgical exploration. For hypertension-related liver diseases, in pregnancy, the mainstay therapy is to first manage the hypertension in the hospital and then deliver. And lastly, acute fatty liver of pregnancy is really isolated to the third trimester of pregnancy as well as the early postpartum period. It is more common in pregnant women with multiples and those who are underweight. Here are the diagnostic criteria for acute fatty liver of pregnancy. And in order to make the diagnosis, six or more of these criteria have to be met. These criteria are largely categorized into symptoms, abnormal tests, elevated white count, elevated transaminases, elevated creatinine, the classic markers of fulminant hepatic failure, such as encephalopathy and coagulopathy, as well as an ultrasound showing fatty liver. And if you do get a liver biopsy, then the liver biopsy will show microsteatosis. But of course, if a patient has coagulopathy during pregnancy, we're oftentimes not recommending a liver biopsy. And the diagnosis can definitely be made using other criteria without proceeding with biopsy. Maternal and fetal mortality is very poor, with up to 18% maternal mortality and 35% fetal mortality. The management of acute fatty liver of pregnancy is immediate delivery. This slide summarizes those four diseases. It's in your syllabus. It really compares the liver test abnormalities as well as the prognosis and the recurrence rate, and it's there for your reference. So, of course, women with abnormal liver tests in pregnancy can have and more commonly have an underlying liver disease that needs to be managed during pregnancy. The most common pregnancy-related liver disease that I have managed in my practice has been the pregnant woman with chronic hepatitis B. With respect to chronic hepatitis B, pregnancy is considered to be an immune-tolerant state. Although flares may occur during pregnancy, they are uncommon. Flares are more common during the postpartum period, which is a state that is immunologically analogous to withdrawal of corticosteroids or withdrawal of rituximab when we more commonly see reactivation of chronic hepatitis B. There are two specific goals to therapy or antiviral therapy during pregnancy. The first, of course, is mother first. You know, if the woman has an indication, a really absolute indication for treatment, such as advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, then one has to start treatment or continue treatment. But the second is really explicitly to reduce the risk of perinatal transmission. And there, when we talk about the indications for therapy in this situation, there are really two predominant drivers of perinatal transmission of chronic hepatitis B. The first is maternal serologic status. So this table shows the risk of perinatal transmission of chronic hepatitis B by the mother's serologic status. So here for an E antigen positive mother, if the infant does not receive immunoprophylaxis, there is a greater than 90% risk of chronic hepatitis B developing. If the infant does receive immunoprophylaxis that consists of vaccine and HBIG within 12 hours of delivery, the risk of chronic hepatitis B developing in the infant is significantly decreased but still quite elevated, 10 or 15%. If the mother is E antigen negative, in the absence of immunoprophylaxis, the risk actually of chronic hepatitis B transmission is not that high. It's less than 5%, although there is still a risk of acute hepatitis and fulminant hepatic failure in the infant. With immunoprophylaxis, that risk of viral transmission does decrease further down to less than 1%, less than 1% risk of developing chronic hepatitis B or fulminant hepatic failure. The second driver of perinatal transmission is the maternal HBV DNA level. The risk of transmission has clearly been demonstrated to increase with increasing HBV DNA despite immunoprophylaxis. At the current time, AASLD guidelines recommend treatment initiation at HBV DNA levels of greater than or equal to 10 to the 8th copies per ml, which is 100 million copies, which is equivalent to 20 million IUs per ml. But as you'll see from this figure, which shows the rates of vertical transmission here by maternal HBV DNA level, you can see that there is still persistent risk even under the threshold that AASLD has recommended. So AASLD recommends initiating treatment here, where the risk of perinatal transmission is 8%. But even when you get to 2 to 20 million international units, the risk of perinatal transmission is 7%. And at 200,000 to 2 million IUs per ml, the risk of perinatal transmission is 3%, which is not incredibly high, but still high relative to the low risk and the high tolerance of and how well tolerated HBV treatment is, and particularly when it initiated in the third trimester. And you'll see in a couple of slides that we as a hepatology group really strongly advocate for and really do practice a more conservative approach as to when to initiate HBV therapy in pregnancy. There are three treatment options for HBV therapy during pregnancy. Lamivudine, telbivudine, and tenofovir have all been studied. But if you look at this table, you'll see that tenofovir has a more favorable pregnancy category, lower rate of resistance, no known risk of birth defects, and a 0% rate of maternal to child transmission. So if you take all of these factors, tenofovir really dominates in terms of what is the preferred for therapy to use. Therapy should be initiated at 28 to 32 weeks of gestational age to allow sufficient time to decrease the HBV viral load to less than 200,000 IUs at the time of delivery. And unless there is another indication to continue treatment in the mother, delivery can be stopped at the time of therapy can be stopped at the time of delivery with close monitoring for risks of flare in the mother after you stop the medication. Here's a summary slide. This summarizes the sort of treatment algorithm as to when and how to initiate therapy in HBV surface antigen positive mother. It comes from a editorial that Monica Sarkar and Nora Tarreau published earlier this year in Hepatology. Please note that they have advocated, and we as a group practice, a lower HBV DNA initiation level than what is recommended by AASLD. So we recommend initiation of HBV therapy at a viral load of greater than 200,000 at 28 weeks. And also, just please remind your patients to remind their OBGYN and their pediatrician to make sure that the neonate gets HBIG and HBV vaccine within 12 hours of delivery. The management of chronic hepatitis C in pregnancy is much more straightforward. The risk of vertical transmission is very low. Risk factors for vertical transmission include HIV co-infection, perinatal complications involving hemorrhage, or fetal scalp monitoring requiring exchange of blood, longer duration between membrane rupture and delivery, and higher maternal viremia. Management has been up until October has been very straightforward because all of the regimens required ribavirin, and ribavirin is pregnancy category X, and so treatment during pregnancy was really contraindicated. However, in light of the recent approval of Harvoni, which can be used without ribavirin, that is pregnancy category B, it will be interesting to see if there are certain subgroups of pregnant women who may be targeted for therapy during pregnancy, such as HIV co-infected population, in attempt to reduce the risk of hep C transmission, vertical transmission. But it's too early to tell at this point. Another common situation in which we're asked to manage liver disease in the setting of pregnancy is a woman with autoimmune hepatitis. Similar to chronic hepatitis B, autoimmune hepatitis may improve during pregnancy, but postpartum flares are common, with rates reported up to 86%. Of the time. The mainstay therapy for autoimmune hepatitis is azathioprine, which is technically classified as pregnancy category D because congenital malformations have been reported in mice studies, and metabolites have been detected in newborns of mothers with Crohn's disease. In a recent meta-analysis, there was a 67% increased odds of preterm birth in women who were on azathioprine during pregnancy. However, there was no increased odds of low birth weight or congenital abnormalities, and there have been no reports of teratogenic effects in human beings. And so while the AASLD guidelines technically do say that azathioprine should be discontinued if possible in patients during pregnancy, given the lack of data supporting teratogenicity of azathioprine, and given the potential risks of flare or even spontaneous abortion in the setting of systemic inflammation if the autoimmune hepatitis does flare, I believe that the risk of continuing azathioprine I believe that the decision regarding continuing azathioprine during pregnancy should really be individualized, depending upon your patient's tolerance for risk of autoimmune hepatitis versus the risk to the fetus. Although pregnancy in individuals with cirrhosis is quite uncommon because most cirrhotics are not menstruating, there is an increased risk of spontaneous abortion, prematurity, and perinatal death reported in cirrhotic women who become pregnant. Portal hypertension will worsen during pregnancy due to the increased blood volume as well as increased vascular resistance from extrinsic IVC compression. And they are at increased risk for hepatic decompensation. One in four patients will develop a variceal bleed during their pregnancy, and this risk is highest during the second trimester when portal pressure peaks, as well as during delivery. And maternal mortality rates have been reported to be as high as 10%. Management can be tricky, but really revolves around managing the portal hypertension. Consider banding the esophageal varices, particularly if you have the luxury of doing it before pregnancy. And propranolol has been used to manage portal hypertension in cirrhotic women, although it is technically pregnancy category C and has been associated with some risk to the fetus. And I would certainly recommend a C-section rather than a vaginal delivery to avoid the Valsalva maneuver. And finally, I'd like to just mention three diseases that are coincident with pregnancy and do seem to occur more commonly in the setting of pregnancy. The first is acute hepatitis E. Hepatitis E is highly endemic in India, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, as well as Mexico, as you can see here from the dark green areas. You'll note that in the United States, it is not highly endemic, but is endemic, so we do see it. Hepatitis E can be transmitted at any time, contracted at any time, but it is more likely to present itself because it is more severe in the third trimester. In fact, 33% to 43% of women who develop acute hepatitis E in the third trimester will develop fulminant hepatic failure. Maternal mortality is very high; it's up to 25% in the third trimester, as compared to 4% in the general population, and fetal outcomes are extremely poor. The management at this time is purely supportive, as well as deliver immediately in order to protect the fetus. Although ribavirin has not yet been reported in the literature as a treatment for acute hepatitis E in pregnancy, ribavirin does have activity against hepatitis E and has been used in non-pregnant individuals. And one should consider the use of ribavirin if you do see a woman who is developing severe liver injury or fulminant hepatic failure in their third trimester of pregnancy, because there will probably be very little overlap between when you give ribavirin and when the patient is scheduled for delivery, because delivery has to be emergent, as well as one has to consider whether there are significant risks of teratogenicity if given during the third trimester for a very short period of time. Biliary disease is, as we all know, very common in pregnancy. Up to 10% of pregnant women will develop gallstones or sludge, but only 0.1 to 0.3% will develop symptomatic biliary disease. After the first episode of biliary colic, 50% of women will recur within their pregnancy, and so one should consider surgical management. Laparoscopic cholecystectomy has been reported to be safe. It is best done in the second trimester, if you can, because in the first trimester, laparoscopic cholecystectomy is associated with an increased risk of fetal death, but in the third trimester is associated with increased risk of premature labor, and also it's more technically difficult because of the size of the uterus compressing upon the right upper quadrant. In a retrospective study that just compared those individuals who happened to undergo medical management versus those individuals who happened to undergo surgical management of biliary colic, surgical management actually did decrease hospital days, labor induction, and preterm delivery. Lastly, 20% of cases of Budd-Chiari syndrome will occur in women who are in a high estrogen state, such as are on oral contraceptives or who are pregnant. Of those women with Budd-Chiari who get pregnant, pregnancy will increase the risk of progression. The clinical features are exactly the same as in non-pregnant women, and the treatment still consists of anticoagulation. But because warfarin is pregnancy category X, a pregnant woman with Budd-Chiari or who develops Budd-Chiari during pregnancy should be given Lovenox, and with a dosing at the BID dosing, not the once-a-day dosing, just to avoid very high supertherapeutic peak levels. And then the recommendation is to convert from Lovenox to unfractionated heparin prior to delivery, probably around 36 weeks, and so the patient just has to stay in the hospital until they are ready to deliver. So in summary, the differential diagnosis of abnormal liver enzymes in pregnancy can be divided into liver diseases that are unique to pregnancy, in which the differential is driven by the trimester of presentation, pre-existing liver diseases in which the management must weigh the risks to the mother of not treating the underlying disease versus the risks of transmission of the disease or medication effects to the fetus, and those liver diseases that are coincident with pregnancy in which the management is relatively similar to that of that in non-pregnant women. Thank you very much.
Really wonderful delivery of a very broad topic. Thank you, Jen. So, yes.
Sure. The question is whether ERCP, the role of ERCP during pregnancy. So, you know, one has to consider the additional risk of the radiation with ERCP. We've done it in our center, especially as kind of closer to the end, you know, third trimester, where the risks are even lower to a fetus that's already sort of developed and grown. I think ERCP has to be done when there's choledocholithiasis. You know, in that case, actually, surgical management is not the best. ERCP is the best. There really have been very few studies that have evaluated that, but it, I can tell you from our center experience, we have done it in our center and very safely. Yeah, so the question was in IBD, the recommendation, one just continues azathioprine through pregnancy. In ASLD guidelines, they just happen to recommend that azathioprine be discontinued. Part of it is that in non-pregnant women, azathioprine technically can also be discontinued, and ASLD guidelines also recommend that all individuals who are not pregnant actually receive a trial off immunosuppression therapy. And so because it is pregnancy category D, ASLD guidelines recommend that, you know, it, technically, there could be harm to the fetus in theory. However, there has been a lot of data out there looking at azathioprine in pregnancy, and there really are not any serious teratogenic effects, just the increased risk of preterm delivery. So that's why I personally recommend that the decision to continue azathioprine should just be individualized to the patient. And I would feel perfectly comfortable continuing azathioprine in pregnancy. I just wanted to present to you that our liver society says we should stop.
Great. Last question, Dr. Safari.
The question was the recommendation to perform C-section in the setting of cirrhosis. So no, it is purely a theoretical concern of increase in portal hypertension with a vaginal delivery and the Valsalva maneuver. Absolutely. No,
And I don't know whether a vaginal delivery would not be, you know, if you can even do a vacuum delivery if you don't want the patient to push, but, you know, to do a blank statement that everybody's got a cesarean, I think I don't know which one it was more risky, so that's
sure.
I wanted to know whether there was any basis on the
So there are so few studies looking at pregnancy and cirrhotics because it's relatively uncommon, and so that recommendation is really sort of expert opinion in the literature and not based on data. But your point is well taken, that recommending cesarean section in someone with portal hypertension may increase the risk of severe bleeding in the setting of in the setting of portal hypertension. So certainly there are additional risks with that. Absolutely. Thank you for your point.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.